listening to the Asia Geopolitics Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, this time recording from an undisclosed location in the Catskill Mountains in New York, where I'm spending a little bit of time this summer.
And this is Katie Putz, your co-host, and I am back in Washington after 3 weeks traveling across Central Asia. So everybody has been on the move this summer.
Yeah. So hopefully listeners will forgive the somewhat patchy release schedule of episodes, but we want to make it up to you. And actually, this episode is going to be a little bit of a grab bag of geopolitical issues. There's just a lot going on, both in the world and specifically in Asia. And so what we'll do this episode is we'll talk a bit about various sources and drivers of geopolitical shifts. We'll talk a little bit, of course, about what's been happening between the United States and Russia, which has global implications given its direct relationship to the war in Ukraine and its many follow-on consequences, as we've been continuously talking about on this podcast for the last 3+ years. And then we'll get into some other stuff. But Katie, I just wanted to kind of go over this fairly historic, controversial summit last week. Well, the decision to have the summit being controversial, but Vladimir Putin on American soil in Alaska meeting Donald Trump. I think going into this summit, the administration had some fairly high hopes, although they tried to remain non-committal on some kind of deal coming out of this. But, it's very classic Trump. Big pageantry, big summitry, art of the deal, put me in the room with the other guy and I'll get some kind of miraculous agreement out. Of course, that's not what happened in the end. But, what are your big kind of reflections on what just happened in Alaska, and what should our listeners really be thinking about in trying to make sense of what comes next for Ukraine and the Ukraine-Russia war?
Yeah, so this summit sort of came together very quickly. The main focus was supposed to be Ukraine, though there had been some talk, particularly from the Russian side, of bringing in discussions of nuclear weapons treaties, given that New START is expiring next February. It seems that didn't quite happen. The two leaders met in Anchorage for about 3 hours. A planned working lunch did not happen. They didn't take any questions at the press conference after the summit, and they went their separate ways. I think some of the most interesting parts of this are first that both Putin and Trump characterized these talks very positively, but neither of them really went into details. And then after the summit, Trump, as he is wont to do, did a Fox News interview in which he sort of said a number of somewhat shocking things, but maybe not shocking in the grand scheme of Donald Trump. He said that he agreed with Putin that the Ukraine war will probably end with land swaps and some kind of security guarantees. He also sort of pushed responsibility for the peace onto Zelensky in Ukraine, kind of suggested that Ukraine wouldn't get Crimea back and shouldn't join NATO. And so some of this is really contradictory. The idea of security guarantees in particular, but not NATO membership, the primary allure of joining NATO is the security guarantees that are baked into Article 5, right? And so some of this is a little confusing. And then immediately after, so the summit was on Friday, the 15th. On Monday, the 18th, Zelensky and a number of top European leaders basically rushed to Washington to meet with Donald Trump. And I think that is also part of this, trying to both manage Donald Trump's idiosyncrasies. He is known to be swayable. And I think there is a lot of commentary about Donald Trump that, he listens to the last person that he spoke to. And so I think there was this motivation to get in the room with him before whatever Putin said to him had really baked in too deeply. And we can certainly talk about the Zelensky EU meeting. But, I'm also curious about how you viewed this summit and sort of the grand scheme of Donald Trump and his, preference for these bilateral kind of talks. He does think of himself as a deal maker. Whether those deals actually come to fruition is something that time tells us.
Yeah, he's got a whole term and now half of a second term to, I think, figure out the essential insight that diplomacy and third-party mediation are actually pretty difficult things to do. And I think nobody should be surprised by the outcome in Alaska, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, the thing you said is actually, I think very important, which is that he does tend to agree and sort of take in the perspectives of the last person he talked to. And I think that happened with Putin. It happened with Zelensky. It was a very smart move, in my opinion, by Zelensky and the Europeans to make sure that they don't let Trump kind of sit with whatever Putin left him with. because I think he thinks that the way to make deals is in a way to pair it sometimes with the other side is essentially trying to prefer. So in a way, I actually don't think we're any closer to getting to any kind of resolution here. I mean, the White House has been insisting in the days since Zelensky's visit that, you know, Putin and Zelensky could meet directly for peace talks, which is obviously something that the Russians have been very much opposed to doing. And of course, for the Ukrainians, a lot of what's on the table is a complete no-go, you know, formal land swaps or anything like that. And of course, the ceasefire issue, which Trump is now setting aside, also, I think, puts the Ukrainians in a particularly difficult position. So I think this is just, you know, very classic Trump. His sort of, you know, he's also been public just in recent days about his very open goal of getting a Nobel Peace Prize. And he's kind of alluded to his role in, or I think the White House alluded to his role in potentially mediating, you know, a number of other crises, Armenia, Azerbaijan, India, Pakistan, and, you know, various other disputes, Cambodia, Thailand, as I talked about with Sebastian while you were away in Central Asia. I mean, it's just remarkable how much pageantry and show and kind of headlines and ratings. I mean, you know, this was, again, a very kind of newsworthy event, which Trump also just really, I think, intuitively enjoys. But of course, the results at the end of the day speak for themselves, which is that there are really no meaningful results. I mean, you know, this wasn't like a major inflection point, even if it did get Trump and Putin to kind of see each other face to face. And then the stuff you know, you kind of alluded to, like the new start and kind of nuclear arms control issues. I think both Trump and Putin might have kind of gone into this with a, you know, we are the United States and Russia, and we will sort of recognize our responsibility to kind of work on these things. I mean, very kind of Reagan-Gorbachev dynamics. But obviously, as long as at least for the Russians, I mean, as long as Ukraine remains unresolved, the broader approach has been that, you know, very little else is possible with the United States. So it will be interesting to see if anything changes about that, especially as we head towards the February 2026 expiration of New START. That treaty cannot be extended again. It was extended once by the Biden administration. And for listeners who don't know New START, that's the treaty that currently caps the number of long-range strategic nuclear weapons that the United States and Russia can possess and deploy. And so if that treaty expires without a replacement, it'll essentially be the first time in about 50 years that the United States and Russia will be without any kind of central strategic limits on their nuclear forces. And, you know, Trump's talked about since the 80s wanting to do a big nuclear deal. That's really in his kind of world vision, kind of frozen in the 1980s. So yeah, I think that's also a fairly interesting dynamic here.
Yeah, I think the last thing I want to sort of add is, you know, with all of the, there are differing opinions about Zelensky appearing with all of these European leaders in Washington sort of immediately after, and sort of the optics of that. My takeaway on that and sort of my view on that is that, you know, this was Zelensky demonstrating that he is not alone and sort of coming with full force. If we can kind of go back mentally to February in his first White House meeting and how sort of horribly that went off the rails for basically everyone involved, this was a demonstration of European solidarity. Now, whether that sways Donald Trump into sort of agreeing with their want to prioritize the ceasefire, their desire to sort of provide security guarantees to Ukraine, and the functional things that need to be done to do that, I don't think we're there yet. But one more question sort of before we leave the Putin-Trump-Zelensky sort of trifecta. Also note there, Donald Trump is attempting to put together a trilateral where we hear between himself, Putin, and Zelensky. We'll see if that comes together. As you noted, Ankit, the Russians aren't particularly keen on that. The Ukrainians want the war to end, but their separate red lines are very far apart still. But I did want to ask you, you know, Donald Trump does really like this big summit. He does like this spotlight. And I get a little bit of a sense of deja vu for 2018, 2019 in the North Korea summits. Now, obviously, these are very different venues and very different topics and strategic issues. But I'm curious what lessons maybe we should take from how the 2018 and the 2019 summits with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un sort of played out in the long term, because you can say an awful lot of stuff even in a joint statement, say 2018 between North Korea and the United States, and then have none of that come to fruition. So I'm curious your take on that before we move on.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's I think it's very similar. The broader kind of diplomatic dynamic, right? It's both kind of cases where you know, Trump's own belief that all it takes for diplomacy and deal making is to be in the room with the other guy, and you know, through sheer force of will, you will arrive at some kind of agreement. I mean, you even talked about how in Alaska they ended up skipping the planned working lunch, which is exactly what happened at the Hanoi summit when mm-hmm. Trump and Kim skipped their working lunch because they met in Hanoi and realized that actually what we thought was going to happen is not what's going to happen. And of course, Kim was kind of humiliated and angry. Putin seems to have, you know, not had that particular type of visceral emotional reaction. They did have the press conference where, you know, they didn't take questions, but they were at least able to do that. But I think it's really just part of this pathological trend. And so every time I think, you know, there are these analysts who kind of fall for Trump's kind of self-acclaimed deal-making role when, you know, every time there's some kind of big headline about, you know, oh, Trump says that, you know, India and Pakistan are going to negotiate in a third venue with Trump in the room, or Zelensky and Putin are going to come together. I mean, it's really just, you know, we kind of end up going round and round, and there's really been no direct evidence that, you know, this kind of deal making ability does manifest in anything real. But of course, you know, for Trump, it is part of playing a role, right? I mean, he, with the North Korea summitry, he was quite pleased about the extremely high TV ratings, right? It was the biggest story in the world, historic summit between an American president and a North Korean leader. And, you know, similarly, the curiosity around Putin, you know, coming to the United States, having the U.S. Army roll out a red carpet for arguably America's greatest geopolitical adversary in the immediate term, at least in Europe. All of that, I think, just generated the kind of curiosity that Trump kind of just relishes in.
Yeah. All right. So now that I've moved us to East Asia, I wanted to ask you also about sort of the Japan-South Korea relationship. We've had sort of leadership changes in both countries in the last year or so, and a number of other issues. And so I'm curious where that stands amid all of this other changing milieu.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't have to talk about this for too long because I think we're about to get some interesting insights, especially with the new South Korean president, Lee Jae-myung, coming to Washington soon. At the end of the month. But notably, you know, we're recording this on August 20th. Lee Jae-myung is about to head to Japan. And what's really notable about that is kind of two things. First of all, traditionally, Korean presidents don't go to Japan before the United States. And it's especially notable that the Korean president going to Japan before coming to the United States is a progressive, right? Under the last progressive administration of Moon Jae-in, Korea-Japan relations entered a really, really dark period for a variety of reasons that, you know, have to do with kind of crises and the broader temperament, historical issues, a South Korean court ruling about restitution for wartime forced labor under Japanese occupation. And I think this has a really interesting kind of geopolitical resonance given what's going on right now, right? I think for many American observers of the Korea-Japan relationship, these historical issues have always been, you know, something that's understandable, but also in a way frustrating for Americans who would like to see Japan and Korea recognize maybe their kind of the core national interests that they share and that kind of pull them together. And of course, you know, even if we weren't living through a second Trump administration and a trade war, Japan and Korea would have a lot of shared interests, right? Growing North Korean nuclear capabilities, a much more dangerous neighborhood writ large as Russia and North Korea are cooperating. China's becoming a lot more interested in kind of economic coercion more broadly. But now with the added pressure that's coming from Washington on kind of defense spending, on trade, you know, I was in both Seoul and Tokyo in July, and I got to Tokyo the day those letters, if listeners remember, came out. And, you know, the view in Tokyo among kind of the strategic elites I was talking to was like a mix of kind of just fear, humiliation, and anger about what the United States was doing. And so this creates, I think, a really, really useful forcing function right now, where even a progressive like Lee Jae-myung can go to Japan. And, you know, I mean, there are sort of complications here. We just had the August 15th anniversary where many within the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, which, you know, did very poorly in the recent upper house elections, went to the Yasukuni Shrine, very much, I think, tugging on some of those historically resonant pressure points that make the Korea-Japan relationship a lot more volatile. But Prime Minister Ishiba, who's still hanging on by a thread, although his fate is very much uncertain, he's kind of avoided kind of throwing himself into the more kind of you know, ideological far-right elements within the LDP, and he's been a lot more pragmatic about coalition building in East Asia with sort of like-minded partners. So I think this kind of speaks to what's really happening right now. So I'll be really curious to see what comes out of the Korea-Japan summit, and then of course President Lee's visit to Washington. Because if the Japan summit goes really well, and the visit to DC might go less well for a variety of reasons, although you know, hopefully that doesn't happen, because they are trying to, I think, manage things on both sides to ensure that there is something of a positive outcome for both Korea and the United States. I think that'll be really, really worth watching.
And we will keep an eye on that. And then, you know, before we close out, I do also want to note that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit is, I guess, the end of next week. It's August 31 to September 1. In light of that summit, it's going to be held in Tianjin, China. Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, is planning to attend, I believe. And so I mm-hmm. think there's some interesting conversation about an India-China rapprochement and what that means within this sort of greater geopolitical shift, and also with the relationship with Pakistan. Some interesting commentary on that.
Yeah. So, yeah, really, I think this is the third big kind of geopolitical shift or reset or thaw that's worth kind of addressing on this episode. Again, I think very much attributable to what's happening in global geopolitics as a result of the United States and the trade war. Although I will say, you know, indications of a potential tactical thaw between China and India have now been percolating for a little more than a year. So yeah, just about a day ago, the governments of India and China announced a broad set of agreements. You know, they're going to open up border access, reissue visas to each other's citizens, resume flights. I mean, it was just remarkable that the world's first and second most populous countries didn't have direct flights between them for a number of years after the pandemic. And for listeners, of course, just to kind of remind everybody of the context, in June 2020, India and China ended up in experiencing the worst direct violence between them in about, you know, more than 40 years along their disputed border in the Galwan Valley in the disputed part of Kashmir that India and China specifically have been really wrangling over for a while. So this is where this process has now led. The tactical nature of this, I think, is really important to kind of emphasize, because obviously the broader geopolitical divergences between India and China have not been addressed. But I think from India's perspective in particular, stabilizing this relationship as the United States actually gets fairly heavy-handed with India, right? The other broader piece of this puzzle is that just in the last few months, India-U.S. ties have really taken a nosedive as the United States has become particularly critical of India purchasing Russian oil. India has been targeted for higher tariffs than I think many in New Delhi had anticipated. And so that creates the conditions for trying to right the ship, so to speak. India doesn't want to be in a world where it has poor relations with both the United States and China, even though longer term, it will remain strategically aligned with the United States. So that's the broader context here. And I think, you know, you're very right to flag the SCO summit, because I think that will be potentially a moment for greater clarity on how India might be looking to engage more broadly within the SCO and maybe with China more broadly. But yeah, that I think is just the last thing that is worth emphasizing on this conversation today, Katie. Do you have anything to add on the China-India dynamic?
Nope, I certainly am going to be watching the SCO as that event occurs, and we'll see a lot about the sort of organizational relationships, but also the bilateral relationships within the SCOs. We've sort of said multiple times on this podcast, the SCO is a bit of a strange beast mm-hmm. at this point. It has brought in a number of members in the last decade, including India and Pakistan, but also Iran. And we have sort of very interesting dynamics there. And I'm sure we'll come back and chat about that in a couple weeks.
Yep. Well, I think we'll leave it there for today. So a little bit of a round robin of a variety of interesting geopolitical tidbits all around Asia. But that is kind of what we do here on the Asia Geopolitics Podcast. So as always, thanks a lot for listening. If you like what you heard on the show, make sure you subscribe. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, but you haven't yet reviewed the show, please do that as well. We really appreciate that feedback. And it helps us improve as we move forward. Katie and I will be back soon with more on the Asia Geopolitics Podcast. Thank you.